So imagine for a second that you're tasked with building a skyscraper, or picture a massive suspension bridge spanning a wide river.
Right.
You've got thousands of tons of steel, tens of thousands of joints to weld, and countless lives that will rely entirely on the structural integrity of your work. But here's the catch.
Okay.
Instead of physically testing the metal, I mean, instead of taking a giant steel beam, bending it, and like stressing it with massive hydraulic presses until it snaps just to see how strong it is, you just sit down at a computer.
Yeah, you just type it in.
Exactly. You type in a few variables and you calculate its exact yield strength mathematically. Before a single spark is ever struck on the construction site, you know exactly how much force that bridge can take.
It really sounds like a modern superpower, especially when you consider the sheer physical chaos of welding steel, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's violent.
It is. You're essentially melting metal at thousands of degrees, letting it mix around, and then watching it freeze back into a solid. So to predict the outcome of that violence using purely math, it feels like science fiction.
Yeah, it really does.
But I mean, it is a reality we've been living with for decades now.
Which is crazy. And that brings us to welcome to today's deep dive. We are going to explore the hidden metallurgy math that basically keeps our modern world standing upright.
It's a great topic.
We're looking at a highly technical and frankly mind-blowing research paper from 1988. It's titled Computer-Aided Design of Electrodes for Arc Welding Processes, Part 2. And it was produced jointly by Cambridge University and ISABI AB over in Sweden.
Right. And our mission today really is to uncover how these researchers figured out a way to mathematically predict the microscopic architecture of complex steel structures.
Which is no small feat.
No, not at all. Because by predicting that microscopic architecture, they unlock the ability to predict the brute physical strength of the weld itself.
Okay, so to really wrap our heads around how you calculate the strength of a massive weld, we first have to understand that large industrial welds aren't just one single giant pour of molten metal, right?
Yeah, you can't just do it all at once.
Right. If you're welding a thick steel pipe or like putting together a ship's hull, you have to build that weld gradually
Yeah,
in layers.
exactly. In the industry, these are known as multi-run welds.
Multi-run. Okay.
Yeah. You lay down one bead of molten metal, you let it cool and solidify, and then,
Just go right over it again.
exactly, you lay down another hot bead of metal directly on top of it, and you just repeat this until the joint is fully filled.
But that layering creates a, well, a fascinating puzzle for anyone trying to calculate how strong the final piece will be, because the researchers point out that this process creates two very distinct types of metal inside the exact same weld.
It does, yeah.
They call the first type the primary microstructure, and this is the metal that cools directly from its liquid state down to ambient room temperature. It's untouched. It's like pristine.
Right. But then you have the second type, which is the secondary microstructure.
Okay.
When you deposit that next layer of, 2,000-degree molten weld on top of the first one, the intense heat doesn't just sit right at the surface, it permeates downward.
Oh, right, because steel conducts heat so well.
Exactly. So it heavily reheats those regions of the pristine primary metal that you just laid down.
And this brings us to why the old ways of predicting strength completely failed. Because before this 1988 paper, engineers generally relied on empirical methods, right?
Right. They basically just looked at the chemical composition of the steel.
Like how much carbon, how much manganese, how much silicon was in the alloy. But the researchers point out a glaring flaw in that method, because reheating a weld changes the physical strength of the metal without changing its chemical composition at all.
That's the kicker. The chemical recipe of the steel in the secondary microstructure is identical to the primary microstructure.
Yeah.
I mean, the atoms are exactly the same.
Wait, really?
Yeah. But the physical properties, the actual yield strength, they're completely different simply because of the thermal cycle it just went through.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second,
Yeah.
because if the chemical recipe hasn't changed, how can the exact same atoms suddenly have a completely different strength just because they got hot again?
It's counterintuitive, I know.
It's like baking a multi-layer cake. You pour your batter, you bake the bottom layer, but every time you add a new layer of batter on top, you have to blast the whole cake with a blowtorch.
That's a great way to picture it.
Right. You are partially rebaking and totally altering the layer underneath. So the ingredients, the flour, the sugar, the eggs, they're still the same, but the texture of that bottom layer is fundamentally changed.
What's fascinating here is that the heat alters the physical architecture of the phases inside the steel. It shifts our entire focus away from chemistry and forces us to look at physical metallurgy.
Ah, physical metallurgy.
Yeah. It's not about what chemical elements are in the metal. It's about how those specific elements arrange themselves microscopically, you know, how they bond and form geometric shapes when they're subjected to these drastic temperature fluctuations.
Ah. So because knowing the chemical recipe alone isn't enough to tell us how strong the bridge will be, we need a mathematical formula to calculate the strength of that physical architecture.
Right.
And the researchers decided to start with the pristine, unreheated layer, that primary microstructure.
Yeah, they developed a model based on the assumption that the total strength of the primary weld can be factorized or broken down into individual measurable components. And this is captured in equation one of the paper.
Okay, let's break down equation one for you because it really is the foundation of everything we're talking about today. The overall strength of that pristine layer is calculated as a combination of three things.
Right, three main parts.
First, the intrinsic strength of pure annealed iron. Second, something called solid solution strengthening. And third, microstructural strengthening derived from the three major phases of ferrite inside the steel.
So let's start with that baseline. If you just have a block of pure iron at an ambient temperature of, say, 25 degrees Celsius, the inherent arrangement of its atoms only provides about 220 megapascals, or MPa, of yield strength.
Okay.
That's your absolute foundation.
And to give you some context, 220 MPa is not going to hold up a skyscraper.
No, definitely not.
The real heavy lifting comes from that third component, the microstructural strengthening. And the researchers highlight three specific microscopic shapes or phases of ferrite that form as the liquid metal cools and crystallizes.
And they vary wildly in strength.
They really do. There is allotriomorphic ferrite, which only adds about 27 MPa to the strength. Then there's Widmanstetten ferrite, which adds 402 MPa.
Quite a jump.
A huge jump. And then there is a Sickler ferrite, which adds a massive 486 MPa of strength.
And those numbers, they represent the specific coefficients for each phase when you're calculating the total microstructural strength.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Why does pure iron only give us an inherent 220 MPa and one type of ferrite, the allotriomorphic kind, gives a measly 27 MPa, but this acicular ferrite gives us an enormous 486 MPa?
It's a great question.
I mean, we are talking about the exact same chemical elements. How do these different microscopic shapes dictate the brute strength of the metal so dramatically?
Well, it really comes down to how these shapes physically resist stress when a massive force tries to pull them apart. Think about what happens when metal fails.
Like when it snaps.
Yeah. A microscopic crack forms, and that crack tries to travel through the material. If we look at allotriomorphic ferrite, it generally forms as shapeless, chunky blobs along the boundaries of the metal grain.
Blobs, okay.
Right, blobs. Doesn't offer much complex resistance to a crack.
So a crack can just zip right past or through those blobs. What about the Widmanstetten ferrite that jumps up to 402 MPa?
So Widmanstetten ferrite forms as parallel, microscopic plates. Imagine a stacked deck of cards or perfectly stacked lumber.
Okay, I can picture that.
It is much stronger and more organized than the blobs, which is why the strength shoots up. But because the plates are perfectly parallel, if a crack manages to align with the direction of those plates, it can travel straight down the line between them relatively easily.
Ah, like splitting wood along the grain.
Exactly like that.
Which brings us to the champion, the acicular ferrite at 486 MPa.
Right. Acicular means needle-like. Acicular ferrite forms as a chaotic, interwoven basket weave of microscopic steel needles pointing in every possible direction.
Oh, wow.
So when a crack tries to move through that basket weave, it hits a needle and is forced to change direction. Then it hits another needle and has to change direction again.
Yeah, it can't just go straight through.
Exactly. Every single time that microscopic crack is forced to zig or zag, it requires a tremendous amount of energy. The basket weave literally drains the energy out of the crack until it stops completely.
That is amazing.
Yeah, that chaotic interwoven geometry is exactly why acicular ferrite offers such tremendous resistance to physical stress.
It is literally about the microscopic physical geometry locking together to resist being pulled apart.
Yeah, if you want a structurally sound weld, you want a high volume fraction of the strong phases, like that interwoven acicular ferrite, and a low volume fraction of the weaker blobby phases.
Makes total sense.
And equation one allows the researchers to mathematically calculate exactly what that primary layer's strength will be based on the volume of those specific microscopic shapes.
Okay, so equation one gives us the perfect strength of that first pristine layer, but we just established a few minutes ago that we're essentially blasting that perfect layer with a blowtorch when the next bead of liquid metal goes on top of it.
We are, yeah.
So how on earth do you mathematically calculate the exact amount of destruction that the blowtorch causes to those beautiful basket weaves of acicular ferrite?
That was the next massive hurdle for them. Once that primary region is reheated by the subsequent run, it transforms into the secondary microstructure. The heat causes the metal to become partially re-austenitized and significantly tempered.
Okay, let me stop you there, because re-austenitized is a heavy piece of jargon. What does that actually mean for the metal?
Fair point. It means the heat is so intense that it forces the atoms in the solid steel to completely rearrange their crystal structure back into a high-temperature phase called austenite.
Oh, I see.
Think of the pristine layer of acicular ferrite like a beautifully drawn, complex picture on an etch-a-sketch. The interwoven needles are locked in place. But when you dump the heat of the next weld layer on top of it, that heat acts like someone vigorously shaking the etch-a-sketch.
It completely erases the drawing.
Yes, it completely erases the rigid crystal structure. The atoms let go of that strong basket weave pattern, and when the metal cools down again, it doesn't form back into that perfect acicular structure. It resets into a softer, heavily tempered slate.
And here is the massive mathematical headache for the engineers. When the metal resets into that secondary microstructure, it loses almost all of its microstructural strengthening.
It really does.
The paper notes that the microstructural strength component plummets from those hundreds of megapascals we talked about down to just 68 MPa.
It is a staggering loss of strength. So to predict the total strength of the final multi-layered weld, the researchers couldn't just guess how much metal was erased by the heat. They had to mathematically predict exactly how much volume of the primary weld turns into this weaker, reset secondary structure.
To do that, they needed to calculate the specific temperature where the steel gets shaken, right? Where it becomes fully austenitic again and destroys the strong structure.
Right. They call this the AC3 temperature.
But the paper points out an incredible roadblock here. There was actually no existing method in 1988 for calculating the exact AC3 temperature for arbitrary steels and heat treatments.
Yeah, they were stuck. But instead of giving up because the exact temperature was impossible to calculate, they found a proxy.
A workaround.
Exactly. They approximated the boundary using what they call the AE3 prime perequilibrium temperature. By calculating this specific thermal threshold instead, they found a way to bridge the mathematical gap.
And that leads to equation 10 in the paper. They discovered a statistically significant correlation between the volume of the secondary region, the weakened erased region, and this AE3 prime temperature.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, finding that statistical correlation was the major breakthrough of this section. By identifying the exact thermal threshold where the etch-a-sketch gets shaken, they could mathematically estimate the precise volume of the weld that becomes the reset secondary region.
So what does this all mean for the calculation? It's brilliantly simple once they solve the underlying math. The total yield strength of the entire multi-run weld basically becomes a ratio.
Right, a weighted average.
Yeah. You take the strength of the pristine primary microstructure and multiply it by its volume. Then you take the strength of the weakened secondary microstructure and multiply it by its volume. Add those two numbers together, and you have the exact yield strength of your complex multi-layered weld.
It elegantly boils down the chaotic thermal cycling of a multi-run weld into a predictable, calculated ratio. But, of course, in physical metallurgy, it's rarely ever perfectly clean.
No, it is definitely not. Because even with their elegant temperature equations and their microstructural mapping, the researchers found one tiny, invisible variable that could completely throw off all of their strength and toughness predictions.
Nitrogen?
Nitrogen gas trapped in the weld. And the numbers here are staggering, but not in the way you might think. We are talking about incredibly low concentrations of nitrogen. The paper states it exists in the weld at only 40 to 120 parts per million. Let's call it ppm.
Right. It's an absolute trace element.
Right.
But despite being there in such microscopic amounts, nitrogen has a potent detrimental effect on the toughness of the weld. It causes severe embrittlement.
Now, if you are listening to this right now and wondering how 40 parts per million of a gas can matter inside a massive solid block of steel, you aren't alone. I had the exact same thought.
It's hard to believe.
Right. Wait. 40 to 120 parts per million. How can a concentration that microscopic essentially poison the structural integrity of a massive steel weld?
Well, this raises an important question about how metals actually bend. The mechanism of embrittlement here is tied to phenomena called strain hardening and solid solution hardening.
Okay.
Both of these effects artificially increase the yield stress of the weld, which consequently causes a dramatic decrease in the material's toughness. It becomes brittle.
Explain that to me. Like, I don't have a PhD in material science.
Yeah.
How does a trace amount of nitrogen actually make a steel beam brittle?
Think about what happens when a bridge bends under the weight of traffic. On an atomic level, the iron atoms in the steel need to be able to slide past one another smoothly.
So they sort of slip and slide.
Yeah, that sliding is what allows the metal to yield and bend without breaking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, introduce atomic nitrogen. Nitrogen atoms are very tiny compared to iron atoms.
Huh?
They are so small that they wedge themselves right into the microscopic gaps between the larger iron atoms in the crystal lattice.
So they act like sand in the gears.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. The tiny nitrogen atoms wedge into the lattice and lock the larger iron atoms in place.
Oh, wow.
So when the massive force of the bridge tries to bend the steel, the iron atoms can no longer slide past each other smoothly because the nitrogen is jamming the mechanism.
And it can't bend.
Right. Because the metal can no longer yield and bend, the stress just builds up until the metal simply snaps. That is why even 40 parts per million of nitrogen can turn a tough, flexible weld into a brittle hazard.
And the researchers had a serious data problem here, right? Because the manufacturers of the welding electrodes, raw materials being melted down, they weren't providing the nitrogen concentration data. The information simply wasn't available on the core wire or the chemical coatings.
Which meant the researchers couldn't just plug a known nitrogen value into their elegant strength models. If they wanted their strength predictions to be accurate, they had to invent a mathematical way to calculate the invisible presence of the nitrogen itself as it was absorbed from the atmosphere during the welding process.
So they created equation 6. They built a whole new complex equation using the electrical heat input and the interpass temperature of the weld just to estimate the amount of nitrogen that would sneak its way into the liquid steel.
It really highlights the sheer complexity of the physics involved. Nitrogen is a diatomic gas. Its activity in the liquid steel varies with the square root of its partial pressure in the gas that is in equilibrium with the liquid metal.
That is intense.
And to make it even more complicated, they had to use things called Wagner interaction parameters.
Okay, let me stop you again, because Wagner interaction parameters sounds incredibly dense. What are they actually trying to calculate there?
Sure. So when you melt steel, it isn't just iron. It is a chaotic soup of trace elements. Carbon, manganese, silica, all of these other elements swirling around in the liquid steel actually influence how much nitrogen the liquid is capable of absorbing.
Really?
Yeah. The Wagner interaction parameters are essentially a mathematical way to account for how all those other ingredients in the soup interact with the nitrogen, either blocking it from dissolving or, you know, pulling more of it in.
So they had to write an equation to mathematically predict how much invisible gas gets dissolved into a chaotic soup of liquid metal, all while it is freezing back into a solid.
Yes.
And even with this brilliant equation, they admit it has a standard error of 25 ppm, which when you're dealing with a total range of 40 to 120 ppm is a pretty significant margin of error.
It is significant, yeah. But it proves the point. Even a tiny trace element fundamentally alters the mathematical equilibrium of the liquid metal, which then alters the final physical architecture of the crystal lattice, which ultimately alters the brute strength of the final weld. Every microscopic detail is completely connected.
So we have gone from the macro scale of laying down multiple heavy runs of hot steel down to the microscopic crack-stopping basket weaves of acicular ferrite and all the way down to parts per million of atomic nitrogen acting like sand in the gears.
Right.
The burning question is, did all this math actually work? Could they truly predict the strength of a weld before making it?
They absolutely did. The researchers took their calculated predictions, which were derived entirely from these complex equations, estimating volume fractions, temperature resets, and nitrogen absorption. And they matched them against actual experimental data measured from large real-world weld samples.
And you can see the vindication of their work in figure 2 of the source paper. It shows a graph comparing the calculated yield strengths on one axis against the actual physically tested experimental yield strengths on the other axis.
The agreement is incredibly tight. The data points cluster beautifully right along the unit slope line.
And for anyone who hasn't looked at a scatter plot recently, the unit slope line is a perfect 45-degree angle cutting across the graph. It represents the exact point where the mathematically predicted strength perfectly matches the physical reality of the metal.
Exactly.
The closer the dots are to that line, the more accurate the math is. And even at relatively high strengths, where the older chemistry-only equations usually failed completely, this new physical metallurgy model held true.
They proved that the yield strength of complex, multi-layered, multi-run welds can indeed be accurately estimated purely by calculation.
It's incredible.
It really is. The volume fractions of the microscopic shapes, the AE3 prime temperature acting as a thermal reset, the complex nitrogen estimates, it all came together to accurately predict the physical reality of the steel.
And for you listening, this is exactly why this deep dive matters. This specific mathematical foundation laid out in 1988 is a core reason why modern engineers can trust the safety of the infrastructure around us today.
Absolutely.
It's the reason we can lay down miles of deep sea pipelines, construct towering suspension bridges, and weld the massive hulls of cargo ships with absolute confidence without having to build a full-scale physical prototype and break it first to see if it holds.
Right.
We trust the math because the math understands the microscopic physical architecture of the metal better than we could ever see with our own eyes.
It shifted the whole paradigm. It allowed for the theoretical design of welding consumables and procedures before a single spark is struck. It's really the definition of computer-aided design, shifting from basic geometry down to the deepest levels of physical chemistry.
It really makes you sit back and marvel at the hidden order behind the chaos. The researchers were able to predict the violent microscopic physical changes of melting and freezing steel purely through mathematical modeling and software.
It's an amazing achievement.
Yeah. It leaves you with something profound to mull over, honestly. If a 1988 computer algorithm could successfully model the messy, fiery thermal cycles of arc welding to predict the strength of a skyscraper, what other chaotic physical processes in our natural world are just waiting to be perfectly predicted once we discover the right equations?